Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 12, delivered on September 28, 2017. The title of this lecture is The Use of Interest Rates in Finance.
Today, the use of interest rates in finance. Interest rates have different definitions, and I've given you a couple of those. Interest rates are the opportunity costs of foregone investments. Interest rates are the rental rate on money. Sometimes you'll hear me say interest rates are the price of money. What I really mean, if I say it that way, I mean interest rates are the rental rate on money or on capital, depending on how long the interest rate is going to be carrying. So that is a good one to start with for this lecture. I'm going to show you something on the board, and then I'm going to walk you through what is going on, and I'm going to see if you can catch on and give some answers to me. This is the real world happening right now, and it has to do with interest rates. I'm going to put this up here. Now, the White House just proposed a set of massive tax cuts. There was no indication of how those tax cuts would be financed, other than that we'll just simply have huge deficits, as we have had in the past when we've done this. The massive tax cuts in 2002 led to the end of the budget surpluses and huge federal deficits, as far as the eye can see, that we've never crawled out of. It just gets worse every year. So we have a tax plan, sends the dollar and bond yields higher. Okay, now, this is where we have to do put in one piece that I've told you before. Now, make sure that you understand it. This is the kind of thing that I could ask on an essay exam question. An interest rate is actually the price of money, the rental rate on money. So if the interest rates in the United States go up relative to interest rates in other countries, then that would make all interest rates would go up. But what it would do is that would make the price of the dollar higher. That explains why the dollar would rise on interest rates rising. So in other words, as U.S. interest rates go up, that's going to mean that the price of dollar money, dollar capital, dollar anything, will rise relative. USD will become stronger, as we say, relative to other currencies. If their interest rates don't go up with ours, then that means that our interest rates are going up, and that would mean that our dollar relative to other currencies would strengthen. Now, here's the next part. This part is not in that title of that article, and I don't believe they talk about that in the article. However, as our dollar strengthens relative to other currencies, that makes their imports to our country cheaper, okay? And that makes our exports to other countries more expensive. So what one implication that is not listed here is that as U.S. dollar goes up, exports from the U.S. become more expensive. in other countries, whose currencies have not gone up. Whose currency. And it also, by definition, just the mirror image of that, imports from other countries to the U.S. will become cheaper. So that means that the stuff that we buy from China, the stuff that we buy from Japan, all the merchandise and toys and trinkets and appliances we buy from China will become cheaper. The cars we buy from Japan will become cheaper. The oil we buy from other countries will become cheaper. Yes?
So why is it when the Fed drops the interest rate that the market becomes more bullish?
The market, because as the interest rate drops, then the cost of capital becomes less, and so it means that companies can get capital cheaper to build new stuff, to hire more people, to produce more products. So driving interest rates down is one thing the Fed loves to do because it stimulates the economy. But of course, the ultimate effect of that is that after a while, that creates inflationary expectations. And that's the problem with that whole trick. The Feds use it over and over again through time. And obviously, after that enormous apocalypse we had in 2008, the Fed cranked interest rates down, just collapsed them to try to stimulate the economy. It didn't work at first because that money was flowing into banks, which were supposed to lend it out at cheap rates. They didn't. They just held on to it and put it into the stock market and into investments in foreign countries and in other kinds of investments. So the recovery was slow because of all that money going to the banks that they were supposed to flow out into the economy, and they didn't do it. They kept crying, oh, credit crunch, we can't be lending that money out, it's ours. Anyway, okay. So the first implication of this is that if this is going on, our trade deficits with other countries will go up. Our trade deficits with other countries. U.S. trade deficit. Now, this is a long chain of events and logic going on here. So you've got to write this down carefully in your notes. It's tough at first. You just have to keep thinking about it and reading it and over and talking to me about it to get it. U.S. trade deficit with other countries goes up. What that means is that we will be buying a lot more from other countries than they will from us. So that means that we will import cheap goods and in the process export American dollars to foreign countries. American dollars will become more valuable because their price has gone up. And so those American dollars will accumulate as foreign reserves in the central banks of other countries. Get all of this down. You have to just keep reading it until it finally begins to make a narrative flow for you. Again, our trade deficits will go up with other countries. That essentially means that as we are importing all those cheap goods, we will be exporting at the same instant, we will be exporting American dollars. Valuable American dollars because they have a higher value now, higher price, and those will accumulate as foreign reserves in the central banks of other countries. So, euro dollars will accumulate in the central banks of other countries. Of our trading partners. Euro dollars will accumulate in the central banks of our trading partners, like China, Japan. The oil-producing and exporting countries, OPEC. Yeah.
Why Eurodollars?
They're called Eurodollars if they're American dollars in central banks of other countries. That's what Eurodollar means. It's not Euro. It's anywhere. It's global dollars. But they have the traditional name, but they are foreign reserves in the central banks of other countries. Now, I want you to keep that in mind, that we are now, if we do these massive tax cuts, that will happen. No question about it. We've seen this over and over again. It is theory, and it is provable by the data, establishable by the data. So I want you to keep that one in mind, because that's an interesting thing that's going to happen here in a little bit when I go through the rest of this. Okay, now, bond yields skyrocketed. Well, what that means, of course, is that if American interest rates go up, U.S. interest rates go up, then clearly the price of securities goes down. Price goes up. Interest rates go up, yields are going to go down, which drives bond prices up. Okay, yields are going to go up, I'm sorry, because remember that every interest rate that we see out there is R sub F plus that risk premium that I showed you in the last lecture. So as this is being pushed upward by the tax cuts, then all interest rates will be, because R sub F is underneath every interest rate, all interest rates are going to rise. And so that's why the bond yields are going to go up, bond prices are going to go down as a consequence. Okay, now, why are interest rates going to go up? The simplest answer to that is this. The U.S. will not have as much tax revenue to pay its bills. So it will have to step up to the plate with more treasury auctions. It will have to borrow more money. It will have to sell more treasury securities. And all that means is that as the government borrows more money, the demand pressure on the capital markets will increase, the price of money will go up, and so R sub F is going to be pushing upward as a result of the fact that the Treasury is going to be stepping up to the plate to borrow a lot more money. It's already borrowing money. That's one of the big problems with government deficits, is that they crowd out private capital borrowing, because as the government borrows money, it pushes interest rates up. Okay, because simply the government, if you're the government and I'm a lender and you offer me, let's say, a yield of 3% on a treasury bond, well, that's okay. Maybe I do it at first, but after a while, you're going to get so desperate for money that you'll come back to me and I'll say, we got to talk here. You keep borrowing money, I'm going to raise the interest rate on you. Okay, and so you say, okay, you don't care. Governments, and it's not just the U.S. government, governments borrow whatever they have to at whatever rate is necessary to get the funds to keep the government going. So if the market, if I say 4%, you say, okay. If I say 5%, you say, okay. Now, you're a private corporation. You need to borrow money. What happens is that in order for you to get me to look at you, you have to offer a better rate than the government does, because there's risk in your corporate bonds. So the R sub F is just a substrate. I get R sub F. You're going to have to compete for capital against me. And as I pay more for the borrow, as the government pays more in interest rate, you're going to have to offer a higher coupon rate to get me to attract capital. Ultimately, that's called the crowding out effect, because that's going to slow down the borrowing of capital by the private sector, because they have to keep upping their interest rates if the government keeps upping the interest rate by borrowing money at higher and higher rates to get its funding. Okay, so now, so what will happen is, another part of this is that federal budget deficits will increase. obviously, because there's not as much tax revenue, tax cut. You don't have as much money. Oh, well, we're going to cut spending. Show me where that was in there. There is no plan to cut spending enough to fund a tax cut of this proportion. Essentially, you would have to wipe out every social program if you just wanted the military to keep functioning to do this. So there is not going to be enough spending cuts. They didn't even talk about spending cuts. There are not going to be enough spending cuts to balance this out. So there's no doubt that the federal budget deficits are going to increase. And that is what's going to drive R sub F up. The risk-free rate, because as the government borrows more, it will put pressure on capital markets. The price of funds will go up. The price of capital, the price of money will go up. That's R sub F. So all interest rates will rise on this. Enter an interesting counterbalance to this process. Over here, now, remember what I told you. Those foreign reserves of American dollars in all these central banks around the world, American dollars can be spent only in the United States. So those foreign capital markets where those central banks have all of those American dollars accumulating because we're exporting dollars as we import goods and services, well, there you go. Those central banks around the world are going to accumulate larger amounts of dollars. They can spend them only in the United States. So what is going to happen as the Treasury goes to the starts selling more paper to borrow the money to get operational funding? Well, those capital markets in those foreign central banks are going to have American dollars to lend to us to fund our tax cuts. Just like we've been doing for so long, we are going to become more reliant on these central banks, which are accumulating American dollars in their foreign reserve accounts. They will go to the Treasury auctions, and they will lend our government money. They will also do, they have money, so they will also use that money for other purposes. You want a home loan? Well, the American capital markets might not have all the money, but there are plenty of foreign reserves that will be able to help with funding that dream home of yours on the outskirts of Memphis in a trailer park neighborhood. Living the dream, living the dream. Well, it is, because we're getting to keep all this. We buy cheap goods, and that flows American dollars to the central banks of our trading partners, and then we get large tax cuts so that we can live beyond our means and all of this good stuff, the federal budget deficits, our inability to generate income in our households and our corporations. Well, we'll just have our stock offerings, our bond offerings, our mortgages, our car loans, our student loans, and they will be funded by our trading partners who are accumulating our dollars because they are so valuable. They'll just sop them up, and then they will lend them back to us in exchange for nothing more than future claims on cash flows for your generation and the generations to come after you. That's the price we pay when we do this. And we've done it before, we keep doing it, and then we bitch about the trade deficits. And there was this forum, nice liberal people, well, we've got to crack down on China and tell them to stop. We're going to put financial barriers on them and punish them. Oh, yeah, good idea. The person who's holding your blood supply up here, let's just snip that thing off. Real good. I tried to explain that. The same people who are always complaining about right-wingers having no brain, when you start talking to them like this, they go bobblehead, and then they say, you're some kind of right-wing Nazi, aren't you? No, this is science. This is the science of finance. And Unfortunately, you guys know this. Your guys are learning this. But you're going to walk into a world of people who are just going to be, where's my new car loan? And how come that, and I want my national park to be funded, and I want a really strong military. Well, good for you. This is the mechanism by which it's happening. Go. Say that again.
The liberals who are willing to pay higher tax rates.
Well, good for them. Higher taxes, what are that? What's that going to do to demand stimulus in the economy? Yes. So they're going to slow down, you up the tax rate. You see, we're caught between a rock and a hard place. That was the thing that was the magic of the 1990s. You had this dynamic tension between an increasingly right-wing Congress and a neoliberal president, and they couldn't do anything too radical. The Congress wanted big tax cuts, and the neoliberal White House said, no, we don't want to do that. On the other hand, the neoliberal White House said, let's expand social welfare programs, and the right-wing Congress said, no, we won't do that. So they were in this sort of dynamic tension, and that was what brought down our budget deficits to the point where we had budget surpluses. Yeah. No, it didn't.
Didn't that create more?
There's no such thing as a bubble, by the way. That's a term that you will use if you want to have other people think you're intelligent. There's no such thing as a bubble. Okay, unless you're sitting in the bathtub and you ate chili before you sat in the bathtub. It does. I mean, we're guys, you know. Okay. But the point there being... No, there was no dot-com bubble. That was all because of interest rate sensitivity of certain types of stocks. New technology stocks are highly interest rate sensitive. And when Greenspan was so pissed off because there were no federal budget deficits and everything was going so well, he didn't want this to be happening because it took the Fed out of the mainstream of economic policy. And when he started jacking up interest rates for no reason whatsoever at the Fed, that was completely contrary to the economy's needs of the time, and the highly interest rate sensitive securities buckled under those interest rate increases that had no basis in economic reality whatsoever. And so we had a snap. But interestingly enough, as hard as he tried to drive the economy into a recession and make it so that they had to start borrowing money again, it didn't happen because the dot-com industry was not significant enough. The interest rate-sensitive securities were not large enough as a part of the economy to cause the problem to expand. And so finally, by the time we get to 2001... we started just spending money hand over fist. We claimed there was a recession. There actually wasn't a recession. And then we got our tax cuts. Then we got our federal budget deficits and back into play again. And then everything, all hell broke loose. We went into an economic slowdown that lasted for years. It wasn't a recession, but... and then the Fed, the government started borrowing money again, so there were Treasury bills being issued by the Treasury, and that meant that the Federal Reserve could buy those Treasury bills to fund the deficits, and then the Fed was back in business controlling the economy through open market operations. This is a complicated story, and I surely do not expect you to get the whole thing in a lecture. Listen to the podcast, read the notes, ask me about it. I can just keep walking you through it. It is a dynamic that is driven by what I am teaching you right now, interest rates in the domestic economy. Now, one lesson that comes out of this is that there is no such thing as an interest rate in isolation. Interest rates exist in a dynamic ecosystem. First of all, you see that there is not one interest rate. There are many interest rates because of the different values of R sub D, R sub M, and R sub L that impact on different types of securities. However, There's also the idea of our interest rate environment relative to the world's interest rate environment, relative to other countries' interest rate environment. So when we act to cause our interest rates to do something, we're not acting in isolation. It has impact on us reflecting back from what it does with our trading partners and their behaviors. In other words, if we raise our interest rates relative to another country's interest rates, that doesn't just affect us in the primary round. It also begins to affect us because it causes our exports from our country to become more expensive, which means, by definition, that imports from other countries become cheaper. And that causes trade deficits, causes a money flow out of the United States to other countries' central banks. And then they accumulate those dollars, and then they bring them back here, except that they have a string attached to them. They'll lend us all the money we want. The Chinese, the Arabs, the Japanese, the Canadians, the Europeans, some South American countries. They'll lend us all the money that we want because they've got it because we gave it to them to get their cheap stuff. But it comes with a string attached that if they're going to lend it to us, we owe them money for generations afterwards. We have to pay it back. So in exchange for that nice money to fund our low taxes, our high consumption, high borrowing lifestyles, we are saying to our future generations, well, it's your problem. You've got to pay them back. And that gives them foreign power over us whenever we do that. Essentially, we can't stand up to countries like China. We can't get tough with the Arab states. We can't put our foot down with Japan or anybody else, for that matter, because we owe them money. And it's very difficult to go and get butch with people who have got you by the... whatever. Keep that in mind, that we give up control of our future by doing what we do. And we keep doing it. This isn't a statement about a current president. We've done it over and over again through history, through the last half of the 20th century and into this 21st century. We just keep doing it. Go.
So, we're just going bankrupt. That's something to do with this. Did they have this issue in their country? They
who did?
Greece.
Kind of, except Greece is just a weird-ass country. I mean, they basically, and this is anecdotal, Greece had large, massive social welfare matrix. It also had a very poor tax collection system. I mean, you were considered a wuss if you paid your taxes. And so that led to these very large budget deficits in that country, which effectively made it so that they kept having to step into capital markets to borrow money to fund this poorly designed large society's choices. Ultimately, what that does is that the Greek currency, which was extremely cheap, so you could buy stuff from Greece at a very low price, it got so cheap that essentially no one wanted Greek currency anymore. And that was led to a terrible crisis. When they went to the European Union, they said, we want to be part of you. The European Union said, well, that's fine. Countries can join us. But we cannot support your crippled currency because your crippled currency is going to be replaced by our strong euros, that money that the European Union uses. So you can't be the way you are anymore because you're going to be using euros. And that means that if you are crippled, that damages the euro overall because essentially we are now underwriting your policies, your economic and financial policies. It was a disaster. It was a real disaster. Ultimately, though, those stories, in a way, they kind of pale in comparison to the next part of the stories that I'm going to tell you here today. And here I'm going to do some this is practical to the extent that you need to know this to function as an informed citizen, and it also helps you because you get very frustrated with people who don't understand this and still want to have their opinions respected. But here's the deal. And there's a mention, interestingly, they have a nice little, I don't know, it's a decent little explanation of this thing that I'm about to tell you has to do with interest rates in the textbook chapter 5. I think it's chapter 5. Yeah, where we are now. It works like this. There's a crisis that is coming. We've actually kind of seen this crisis here in Illinois, but it's a much larger crisis that will happen across the country. And best guess is that this is one of those things where no one is talking about it. They point to Illinois. Boy, were you stupid to do that. But the problem is, it wasn't just Illinois. It's many states. It's in the public sector, but it's also in the private sector. And all anyone is doing is looking. It's sort of like, you know, there's some dog who took a crap on the floor over there. They're not noticing that there are 500,000 dogs all around the room taking a crap. They're looking at that. Boy, that pisses me off. Here's what's going on. When you're all going to participate, I'm almost sure almost all of you are going to participate in some kind of a pension plan. Now, that will be in addition to, many of you will also contribute to the Social Security Trust Fund, and real hoping that there will be some of that for you when you retire. But a lot of you will be pinning most of your hopes on the pension plan that is being provided by your company. Now, states provide pension plans for their employees. For example, I've got a pension plan set up for me with the state teachers' retirement system here in Illinois, and they've just sent me something that if I teach for another 20 years, I can get like $400 a month. You know, let the good times roll. I kid you not. It just, I mean, I'm already shopping for cat food. But hey, Amazon will deliver it by drone, so I won't have to carry my crippled body to the store when I'm 80 to buy it. Okay. Pension plans, most companies and states and some in some way, shape, or form, they provide some provision so that you put money into the plan and then you get money out when you retire. In other words, you are in some kind of an annuity, okay? You have some kind of annuity. You're putting in payments every paycheck, and at the end, there's this pile of money that then becomes an annuity coming back to you during your retirement years. That's how pension plans work. It's what we've already done in this class. Some of them get a little complicated one way or the other, but it's pretty simple. Essentially, what happens is that the annuity proceeds forward through your working life, and then at some point, let's say 40 years from now, 39, 40, you're putting money into the plan all these years. And you find the future value of that annuity at your projected retirement date, okay? And you've got all this nice fat money in there. Some kind of there'd probably be some kind of an annuity due structure to it, I guess. Okay, and then you've got some big fat FV. That's the money in the account when you retire. They won't let you take it all out at once. What will then happen is that they will say, all right, based upon that, for the projected actuarially good estimate of how long you'll live, we're going to define a benefit that will come to you as monthly payments. They will define the benefit based upon the what they expect their average annuitant to live. They use the word annuitant. How long the average annuitant lives, and then they define the benefit per month based upon that and based upon their projected future value that will be there. So they would define my benefit as $400 a month based upon how many years they think I'll live in retirement. Like I'm going to live that long the way I live. But and so they define the benefit. There's the problem right there. One problem right away is the defined benefit plans, because it's based upon a projection of the average annuitant's life. In other words, how many payments would be coming out of that future value. But the real problem isn't that. The real problem is what you have already learned how to do. Calculate the future value. Because, and you can find this a short narrative on this in the book too. What these pension plans do to calculate their estimate of the future value is they assign a high interest rate. Like the typical one just pulled out of thin air in both private and public pension plans is 8%. They project forward the future value at 8%. That makes for a nice, fat future value. At 8%, you get darn good FV on that. I mean, you can do it yourself. Just put in I'm going to show you one here in a minute. Let me do it right now. I'll do this, and this is where I get to the practical thing on this lecture. Okay. If I can find my please tell me. Where was that? Did they delete my report? Boy, that irritates me. Download documents. There it is. Okay, the virtual. Why does it ask, do you want to run this? No, I just double-clicked that for no reason. Okay, clear it. Watch. Okay, so I'm guessing, madam, I'm guessing you're about 21 years old, okay? Well, I do that for anyone. Pro tip, do not ever overestimate a lady's age. Unless you have a good dental plan. Okay, mind you, woman. Let's say that you plan to retire. You've got a pension plan. You've just gotten a job. You've got a pension plan. You plan to retire at the age of 67. Now, I'm just going to use in my head calculation. So that means that when you're 22, you'll start a job, and at 67, you'll be done. So that's 45 years, right? Okay, let's do this calculation here. And this isn't actually all that far off. So what's going to go on is we're going to do apps, finance, TVM solver. And the point of what I'm doing here, you've done this. I've already shown you how to do the calculations, to do the assignments in Chapter 5 online. So now we're going to go back and we're going to see how we can look at things a little bit more interestingly. 45 years, and we're going to do 12 payments. You get a monthly paycheck. Now, let's say that as pension plans often do, they discount and go forward with an 8% annual. So that would be 8 divided by 12 since they're monthly payments. There's no initial kicker. There's no PV. And so let's say that every month your defined payment. Now there's another thing too, is a lot of times it's not a defined payment. It's a defined benefit plan. But let's define the payment here at $200 a month. and they occur at the begin. Well, they'll occur at the end of the period, but it doesn't matter with something this huge, this long in duration. Now, let's look at what the future value, FV, how much will be there by their estimate when you retire, okay? The future value would be alpha solve. Is that? Yep, $1,054,907.98. By their projections, this is what will be there. And now we could actually go back and say, okay, let's go back now and say that you're going to live 20 years. So we're going to pay you a defined benefit for 20 years. Okay. And this now becomes the present value of a payment stream for 20 years times 12 months per year. We'll use the same interest rate. But this time, what we're going to do is we're going to calculate what payments we could give you off that with a present value of negative this amount. $1,054,987.978. Okay, and now we can get rid of that future value because we've got what we want from that. Now let's see what your payments are going to be out of that account. But your defined benefit, alpha solve. Nope. Did I do that wrong? 8%, $1,000,000 for 20 years with a present value. Well, let's do it. Yeah, there you go. My goodness, that's a nice paycheck, isn't it? But the problem is that 8% is something that you would invent as a discount rate if you were on some very, very interesting pharmaceuticals. Let's go back and do this again with a realistic. Pension plans are not going to make 8% per year. For those 45 years, most likely, what you're, well, 12 months per year, most likely, you're going to get somewhere around the long-term risk-free rate because you can't be investing in dangerous securities. It's a pension plan. You're going to be buying ultra-safe bonds, treasury bonds, AAA-grade corporate bonds. The best you could really hope for is maybe 3% a year. Divide that by 12. Now the PV will set to zero. And now we'll see what, and we're going to put that $200 a month into the bank. Now let's see what the future value is really going to be. Go.
Why did you divide that by 12?
Because it'll be monthlies. You'll be having monthly payments.
Did you do that last time?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Okay, so now let's see what the alpha solve is under a real, under a much more realistic. Oh, my. Do you see the difference when you change 8% to 3% on what the FV is that will be there at the end to fund the pension for her? Instead of over $1,000,000, you got $220,000 that's got to last her 20 years with payments every month. Well, let's go back and see how that's going to work. She's going to live 20 years times 12 payments a month at that interest rate. And we're going to put in the that future value now as the present value of the cash flow stream, negative 220074. 228? Okay, thank you. I am so bad at reading numbers these days. 2288, is it? 80. I could read that if I really wanted to. I just choose not to. 74.594. Now we can get rid of that FV and put that to zero. Let's see what your payments will actually be. Should be. If there's only $228,000 when you retire in your funded pool. Alpha, solve. Well, that changes the dynamic. A $1,200 a month check. That's basically, okay, that's fancy fees. It's not terrible. $1,200 a month to live on for the rest of your golden years. Unfortunately, that's what should happen. They should be adjusting the interest rate down so that they define your benefit as $1,264 a month. But they didn't. They defined it at $8,000 a month. So what that means is that this pension plan will be busted. And now, because we've been doing this for decades, this insanity, the problem is going to come home, because we will have contracted for all of these old people retired. We're going to give you that $8,000 a month. Oh, yeah. Contract. And they're going to say, we don't have money for that. Uh-oh. And that's what happened in Illinois already. But it's going to happen in almost every state and many, many private pension plans with defined benefits. They already promised, guaranteed, these high payments because they overestimated the future value of the premiums people were putting in. And as such, and the reason they did it is because of the subject of this lecture, interest rates. You choose the interest rate that is right. Don't be pie in the sky. Don't pull it out of your butt. We actually have mechanisms that I'm going to teach you for finding the right interest rate to use to calculate things. The same thing, by the way, let me not pick on pension plans. The same thing actually happens in corporate decision-making. I'm going to show you in a few lectures the decision-making process that is used to decide whether or not to take a project on. It's basically you take the present value of the future expected cash flows that will come from a project. Okay? So what happens in that circumstance? What happens in that circumstance is quite simple. We get our present value of all of this stuff. It's actually called a net present value, because you have a negative amount here at period zero. That's your investment in the project. And then as time goes on, you are going to realize positive cash flows coming out of it. And those will be positives, okay? And then what we do is we pull everything back to the present, all of the numbers. The negative amount, the original investment, is already here at the present. And we get a net present value. If it's positive, we say yes to the project. If it's negative, we say no to the project. It's very simple at the end. The real problems are twofold. One is pie in the sky estimates of how much money is going to come in and when it will come in. That's a real problem. Yeah. Because, okay, you're online. There is no video connection. There's just an audio connection. And you're talking to someone you kind of want to get to be very interested in you. There's no way for that other person to verify that you are who you say you are, that you look like what you say you look. So what you explain is that you are actually, you look like Captain America, but you have You live in a mansion. Gee, I wish you could see the mansion, but you can't. And essentially, you have no incentive not to lie. Again, it goes back to the old first rule of warfare. Never assume an opponent's intentions, only his capabilities. Because there was no, and there has been, no regulation saying, defend this discount rate you're using. What was to stop them from using a pie-in-the-sky discount rate, 8%? Well, Willie reinvests his money at 8%. Ha, ha, ha. You see, there's another little side to that story before I finish this. Some pension plans actually had some plans that were pension-oriented or something like that. They actually were using 8% or 10%, which would be irresponsible except that they were actually making investments with expected yields of 8%, 10%. They said, well, you know, if we're going to use this, well, we obviously have to invest our money at this. A lot of the pension plans were saying, we'll use 8% for our rate, but we're going to invest in super safe stuff. There were some, in fact, I can tell you, I could mention to you one place here in town that did it, where they were using 8% for their calculations, but they were really investing in the kinds of risky instruments that would bring 8%. Here's the problem, though. The greater the expected return, the greater the risk you bear. Well, the problem was that this pension plan went down into the seventh level of hell when these investments turned ugly. What they were doing to get 8% yields, they were investing in real estate securities. And when the real estate market essentially went the way of the dodo bird back around the turn of the century, their pension plan just went to hell. It went down like a rock. I think it lost close to 90% of its value. Total disaster. So, you see, the thing is that your responsibility is to protect the investments of those you are overseeing, those annuitants, those future annuitants. That's fiduciary duty. They can't watch you. You have to watch yourself as their agent. But they, in either case, the fiduciary duty was being violated. If you used an 8% interest rate, but you were really investing at 3%, you were lying. If you were using an 8% and actually trying to get 8%, you were taking risk that was inappropriate to the investments. Appropriateness of investments is a huge part of compliance in the brokering world. But they were getting by. In either case, it was irresponsible. Don't make up numbers. First of all, what's your responsibility? Safety. Okay, what is the interest rate that goes with safety? 3%. That, it should have been plain logic to you. And the way I put it in a higher level class, and I'll tell you this right now. When you get out of here, you might think you can do this too. You'll be a hero and all that using the wrong interest rates or investing in things that are wrong. No, because, and this is not for you because most of you aren't finance majors, but if you are a finance major and I find out that you've done it, I will come and I will kick your ass. And they believe me too because I have done it with some of my former students who started getting really irresponsible in their, wow, I'm a big finance person now. I'm in Chicago. I can do what I want. No, because I come up there and I can find a way into your secure office, okay? You don't believe me? Look at my artwork. You'll see there are photographs of Chicago from the top of the Chase Tower. You're not allowed to stand up there. I was up there, I took photographs. Okay, now, here's the first problem. Overestimating, first of all, the size of what you're going to, of the money you're going to make from a project. That's a big problem. Another one is actually a little bit subtler. It's overestimating the time, it's misestimating the timing of a project. One thing that you will see is companies that start projects new consumer goods or new factory equipment, new technologies, and they'll say, well, we're going to start realizing these great benefits real fast. They don't understand that management science tells us things don't happen as fast, especially with new technologies. You think that's going to suddenly make your productivity jump through the roof and you're going to make a lot more money and all that? No, usually there's an adaptation period. You think the consumers are just going to fall in line and love themselves your new product? No, it's going to be 3 yards in a cloud of dust getting brand loyalty. If you're trying to transfer from an existing product, it's going to be a long haul. It's going to be a worse haul if you're bringing a new product online. Another thing that can be a false signal is a flash in the pan where you see a new product come online and everyone jumps on it. But then you start saying, see, all my estimates were right. But then you find out that your competitors are going to jump in there and then you're going to be left in the dust as your competition is going to take dollars away from you. So a big problem is misestimating how big your positive cash flows are going to be and then also misestimating how soon they will happen. That's another problem with these kinds of things. Truth be told, don't expect, if you're going to start your own business, and I've learned this from painful experience, you're not going to be famous overnight. It's going to take a long time. When I first did my artwork, I thought, well, this is going to sell like hotcakes. I've had people tell me that I'm just incredible, so I'm going to go out there and make high estimates. Well, it turned out, no. Because it took years to develop the media attention. It took years to develop the word of mouth spreading among people. It took years for my signature to finally have value on one of my prints. So that's the thing. Now, the other problem is also that when you discount these cash flows back, the lower the discount rate you use, the higher the present value will be of them. If I discount this, like this fourth year cash flow, if I discount this at 4%, its present value is going to be a lot better than if I discounted it at 10%. So there is this tendency, even in project analysis, to use lower than you should discount rates because those are more likely to get you a positive net present value when you compare the present value of the future expected positive cash flows to the negative initial investment cash flow. That's actually a pretty severe problem. And of course there's also this problem too of misestimating how much something's going to cost. Quite likely, you think, well, we're going to put in an initial investment and then we're just going to sit back and the money's going to come to us. Let the good times roll. I've consulted enough companies that realize, okay, we put money in here. Wait, we've got to shovel more money in period one. Now, what the heck? Can we get a product out? Well, yeah, but we're still going to have to put some more money in two, three. That's one of the problems is not understanding the negativity of your cash flow. How long it can take pouring money in before money starts to come out in a regular stream. The example I think I gave you in class, did I mention the McDonald's pizzas? You know McDonald's made pizzas. Yeah, it was wonderful. They were delicious. I mean, they were incredible. And it cost a lot of money up front when they did this. They had to put in new ovens. They had to train. They had to create new supply chains for the pizzas. They had these little individual pizzas. Then they had these big family-sized pizzas. Well, they accurately did the how much it's going to cost to put these ovens in and do the training at all the McDonald's. But what they didn't realize, think about it this way. You go up to the, you, madam, are a McDonald's waitress, hostess, cashier. And you're at the drive-thru, and you say, may I McHelp you? And I say, well, McYes, I would McLike a McPizza, and yes, they were called McPizzas. What size pizza would you like, McSir? And so I say, well, I would like a McFamily size. Okay, please pull up. I pay my McMoney, and you can't make that pizza. These are fresh pizzas. You have to prepare it. So you say, will you pull up and sit there? So for 10 minutes, I'm sitting there with all of these other McDonald's customers waiting for their pizzas, filling up the parking lot. Okay. Then they have to have runners come out, which means that they have to have dedicated employees that are picking those pizzas up, getting them out there, misestimating costs. They had to think about expanding parking lots and having a waiting area, their surface lot expansion. And then something else happened. Okay, have you ever been to a McDonald's drive-thru window or a drive-thru window of any fast food place? What happens when you try to put a McPizza box through there? Or, hi-ha, in the middle, here's your McV pizza. It was a disaster. And so they started the process of bashing out their drive-through windows, trying to expand them, cost. They started trying to do other things like speed up the pizza-making process with research and development, McMicrowave pizza or whatever. They tried all kinds of ideas, tried to design a box so that they could slice the big pizzas in two and put them like that to get them through. R&D costs. Their costs just kept flowing, and they finally gave up on the whole idea of the McDonald's pizza, which was stupid of them because it was one of those things where the idea was still good, but what the it's just that the execution was bad from the beginning. They misestimated, their planning was wrong. They wanted to put everything in place just like most corporations. We're going to get it all ready and then we're going to go and make money. Yeah. No, it doesn't work that way. They should have known that there was going to be a practical, real-world learning curve. After all the theory was done, after all the planning, they should have said, okay, we know we're going to have real screw-ups in here. Plan for it. Plan not just for the money part of it, but also plan for the action teams to get it solved as quickly as possible when we go out there with it. The individual-sized pizzas were delicious. They could have stuck with those. With the large family-sized pizzas, they simply could have said, those are only available in-store. We do not do those in the outside on the outlots. We could, and I mean, they were huge in the store. Kids' parties, birthday parties, those big pizzas were a great hit there. But instead, they just did what, almost like a petulant child. Well, crap, let's throw it all away. Instead of saying, all right, rebuild, we can do this, but they didn't do it that way. Let that be a lesson to you. When you make a pizza, ask yourself, are you going to deliver that through the drive-thru window, or are you going to invite people into your home to eat it there with you? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.